Hi, hello. We have a fun episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. First, we play a little game of trend or trap. Some interesting things that are popping up league-wide, team-specific, player-specific. We talk about those trends and if they are real. We'll see them in the playoffs, or if this is just kind of a brief little blip right now. And have fun with that conversation from there. We talk about some teams that have us a little concerned or just have some big picture questions that are worth exploring. What's going on with the Orlando Magic? What should the Milwaukee Bucks do? How good is this Raptors group? Do they need some reinforcements up front? What do we do with the Los Angeles Lakers who rack up wins but don't have the profile of contender, at least statistically? We have some fun with that. We talk about the Rising Stars announcements, and then we get into the recent play in unrivaled big performances, big games. Learned a lot about spacing over the weekend. We're going to have fun. We hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan. And joining me, as always, is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here. Excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Ready to talk some hoop with you, good sir.
We're going to have some fun today, Steve. At the top of the show, we're going to play a little game called Trend or Trap. Some things that have been happening league-wide, some big, some small. We want to talk about what's happening, why these things are happening, and how real is this going to be? Is this something that we need to worry about come playoff time, or is this just a regular season bit right now? And I'm excited to dig into this because we had some different ideas as we were kind of tossing things back and forth before we got the show together. So I'm excited to see where you landed. I got to nerd out a little bit, so thank you, or I'm sorry for indulging me in this, but I'm excited, Steve. I want to start with you, friend. What is catching your eye as Blake?
Well, you know, trend or the trap, trend or the trap. My mind immediately goes to traps, and that's where I wanted to start with. And I want to talk about Cade Cunningham and the Detroit Pistons and the matchup they had with the Houston Rockets. And The Pistons are great, right? They established themselves as the top team in the Eastern Conference. Their identity and their defense has allowed them to separate and consistently perform. And I always talk about, Nikias, how the season is a journey, right? We're always collecting data. We're always trying to figure out what a team is, what do they do well, what do they struggle with, how they adjust, how do they improve. You learn more and more about a team as the season goes on. And once you know who they are, you can zero in on different things. And so we are knock, knock, knocking on the door of the All-Star break, right? Which, PSA, by the way, folks, things can and will get a little silly around this time. So don't ride the roller coaster too hard. But once you come out of the All-Star break, after those first few days, it really becomes a sprint towards the playoffs. And so your mind starts to laser in on things a team may have to solve come playoff time, especially if they're in the contender position, top seed, top five seed. You know where they're going to end up, or you know where they're headed. Not necessarily something's a fatal flaw, but something that you want to keep an eye on to see how many teams want to do this to you. What do teams think they can take away from you to make you not this machine or the team that you are, the performance that you've done well? And how does that team handle it? So I wanted to talk about Cade Cunningham against traps, because that intrigued me during the Houston game. But we could dive a little bit deeper into that. Houston actually layered it. They started the game with a guard or a wing on Jalen Duren. They put Alperen Şengün on Ausar Thompson. And they, on top of the fact that they were trapping. And so, okay, who are we using as a screener? Is it going to be Ausar? Is it going to be Duren? Does it change anything that we're doing? Let's use Jalen Duren as a screener. Hey, maybe that's a switch. No, it's a trap. We help and we recover. Let's get a switch and we put Kevin Durant in action, right? And then see if they want to switch that one. It's still a trap. And Houston was set on helping and recovering. And offensively, we have to end up working to find something. So, hey, Reed Shepard, come here, buddy. Maybe you'll show. Maybe you'll trap. Either way, I'm turning the corner. But I think the brilliant thing that Detroit did was they adjusted, okay, and said, hey, let's get Cade Cunningham off ball. Let him work to get the ball lower on the floor, make the big move so the trap isn't as automatic, and you shift the spacing so the dunker spot is clear and you can get downhill a different way. But it didn't change how Houston wanted to help. And so that's the key battle. What are you going to do when a team is able to figure different things out and able to put you in a different spot? Can you get pick and roll back on the table? When Houston's able to help and recover, how does that affect you? And what do you get to next? And that's where it gets really tricky. You get a pin down to a pick and roll, You know, Cade does a good job of knowing what Houston wants to do, and he's able to mix in rejects to get downhill and open up the role. I think one thing that we did see, and we talked about this, when teams are looking to attack matchups, right? An offense is trying to put someone in action. The defense is trying to pre-switch it and change the matchup, right? And so we want this defender here. An offense being able to kind of have whoever switched out comes out of screen anyways, Detroit was kind of able to mess with that a little bit, you know? But they couldn't necessarily completely focus in and poke at it in a different way. But they changed the spacing. So K is able to come off the screen. Now either let's cut from the dunker spot. Let's make sure we clear the wing, get a clean roll, and we can finish. That gets tricky. Duncan Robinson, hey, you know I'm going to shoot. I'm up here. Hey, I'll screen as well. And then Jalen Duren comes up, and now we get the trap, but everyone else is moving, so it puts you in a different position. And so that's the battle consistently. But I think when you're able to kind of move different pieces off the table, can you get back to your main dish? Because you get pick and roll, you get trapped, you get help. If you don't take that off the table, the defense isn't going to shift. They're not going to move. So even if you were able to have success off ball and get to the wide pin downs and allow Cade to see the space, see the floor, attack and finish, you have to still be able to get back to your main priority, you know? But I that's the one thing we don't talk about, the adjustment to, okay, we need to get Cade going. Even if pick and roll is not working, if we get him off ball, we can still get to what we want to do. And I think that's something that doesn't get appreciated as much in the battle of, oh, well, coaches' adjustments. No, we're trying to figure out how to get this back. We're working very hard to figure out how to get this back. That's where it gets fun. And so, like, for me, it's a trap. Obviously, Detroit has to figure that out. I don't necessarily know if it's a secondary playmaker that opens things up, because you have to establish that secondary playmaker, Nekias. I don't know if it's just spacing in general or just being more concise with how you want to space the floor. But I think if you're Detroit, that's something you're going to have to work through in the back half of the season to prepare for the playoffs.
Mm-hmm. I think that's fair. One, fantastic job on that, by the way. I really enjoyed that. Two, it is very funny that we talked about Shea getting the traps from Houston, and now we're talking about Cade getting the traps from Houston. We're just going to have to talk about Houston's defense very soon and what they're doing. Just a fascinating basketball team. But to everything that you said there, and to just the general Cade point, like, this is something that I have asked you about. It's like, just more so a general half-court offense thing with Detroit. Like, do they have the requisite spacing? Like, how good is Cade plus Duren in a playoff context? And so it's been kind of fun watching them overall this year just have, like, a top 10 offense for most of the year. And it's like, okay, I see it. I still have some questions, but I see it. And now you get into these kind of, like, playoff-type field matchups where Cade is getting this degree of two on the ball. Quickly to that, about 38% of his pick and rolls saw a blitz or just two on the ball in general. That was the second highest mark in a game this season. Shout out to the Brooklyn Nets, who eclipsed 40% in one of their games. So it's nice to see that. And I think, to answer your question towards the end, I think they do just need more shooting, period. It would be helpful if they are able to acquire a secondary playmaker that also shoots. You could just kind of cross two boxes at once. But they do need more space, because I think the thing that immediately popped for me as I was watching that game and then watching the clips that you put together, I'm just looking at who's on the floor. I was like, okay, cool. Jalen Duren and Asar Thompson on the floor. If one's in action, we can help off of another, or we can put a weaker defender in one. We're not super worried about it right now. You get to some of the second unit. Okay. Ron Holland's on the floor right now. We can still do the same thing defensively. We still have a similar level of comfort with, we may not want to help off of Duncan Robinson or insert shooter here, but we have a bunch of help points to where we could put two on Cade, immediately take away the role if we want to, and we are funneling shots to someone that we are not scared of. And I think for Detroit, it would be helpful if they add another guy to at least make defenses think a little bit more. Because as you always say, Steve, you get to the playoffs, like, yeah, you have this game plan, and yeah, you have the logic of we're helping off this quote-unquote non-shooter. If non-shooter knocks down four threes in a playoff game and you win, it doesn't matter how good the process was or how sound the logic was. That guy got points and your team lost. And so I do think, again, you want a little bit more wiggle room if you're Detroit. But I'm fascinated by teams ramping it up. And I was kind of waiting on more teams to decide, actually, Cade looks better. Jalen Duren looks better. We both have those guys as all-stars this year. We're just going to make these other guys beat us if we can help it. It was a very extreme example from Houston, but I do think we're going to see more of it. Like, I think that is, you know, to answer the kind of the question, the theme of the segment, like, I think it is more of a trend. Honestly, I think more teams are going to do it. One more quick thing from me, Steve, because I was looking this up in preparation. Cade Cunningham has seen two on the ball on 160 pick and rolls so far this year. And of 19 guys that have seen two on the ball at least 50 times in pick and rolls, Steve, Cade Cunningham's points per possession number on those reps, 19th of that 19-player group. That's not what you want to see. When you have that kind of volume and the efficiency is that low, I think more teams are going to decide, yeah, let's just live with these results until Detroit consistently proves that you can't do that.
I mean, I think it's a tricky balance, you know, because I went in trying to figure out, okay, we've talked about this. How much do you want to trap him? Because you are now handing Detroit, in theory, an opening. We now, as a team that struggles with spacing, in theory, struggles with shooting, in theory, have you in rotation that should open things up. What happens when it doesn't? And so that's where it gets tricky. And to your lineup point, Detroit's built on defense. So they're going to have some tilted lineups the opposite way. You know, kind of like if you remember the Memphis Grizzlies, it's like, yeah, we're sacrificing a little bit of this offense because of what the defense is doing. And so Detroit has kind of embraced that dog mentality. And now it's, you have to be crafty to figure out how to navigate teams saying, hey, we don't care about these guys. That's fine, because we need that on the defensive end. Detroit can't tilt too much offensively, because if you lose part of that defense that's been so strong, are you the same team? So, you know, I won't belabor the point, because I do want to get to your trends because they fascinate me. But it's an interesting concept for the Pistons right now.
I like it. I guess the quick question I ask you before I officially flip, and this kind of flows into what I want to talk about anyway, like how important is Ausar Thompson to kind of solving this for Detroit in a way? Because of his use, you know, you talked about Cade being used off the ball. Ausar can initiate. Ausar can be used as a screener. Ausar in the dunker spot, if you are putting two on the ball, and Jalen Duren's handling, like, he can kind of be that low on the floor threat for you. Like, how important is he to helping Detroit with this?
Very. And I think Detroit's, as you mentioned, with everything you laid out, has found counters to make sure that he's impactful no matter what defenses want to do. But that's why the Houston thing intrigued me so much, because if you like think about a team like Boston, they're not going to be afraid to put a wing on Ausar and turn him into something different, or put a big on Ausar and turn him into something different. So it's more, is he going to gain the understanding of what teams are trying to do to him and be able to poke at offenses? Because that's really all he has to do. He doesn't have to be this constant force offensively. But, hey, I need to make you pay for this. I need to make you think about how you want to defend me and us. That's the larger scheme. It's a back and forth. It's chestnut checkers, as some would say. I am trying to get you to stop doing this if I'm the offense. If I'm the defense, I'm trying to take something away. And for an offense, all I have to do is poke enough holes into your game plan to make you think, ooh, this isn't going to work.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
right there. Like that's kind of where it lands.
I got you. We'll dig more into Detroit as the season goes on. They've been a very good team, but this is going to be something that they're going to have to solve, especially if team defenses get more comfortable with sending to and showing help elsewhere. I want to zoom out with my first trend, Steve.
Okay,
offensive rebounding is back in a really big way this year, and it is fascinating to me. And I think overall, this goes back to some of the conversations that we had during the W season. Like, I've always been of the mind that teams generally choose one or the other when it comes to crashing the offensive glass and working for extra opportunities, or getting back on defense. Let's make sure we don't give up easy baskets in transition. Let's be able to set up and let's just kind of muddy this thing up. And the Golden State Valkyries last year on the W side was a team that intrigued me, because they felt like the rare team that was really good on the offensive glass. And also, you're not getting the free runouts against them either. They're doing a very good job of accounting for matchups, getting matched up very quickly. You just don't get the free stuff. And then we get to this NBA season, and the Phoenix Suns kind of operate in the same way, to where we are going to be a high-octane offensive rebounding group. We have Mark Williams in the middle. We got Dylan Brooks and Ryan Dunn off the bench, and a bunch of guards and wings that are comfortable crashing. But also, because we do such a good job of tagging up, which is essentially the shot goes up, we are getting hands on someone. We are immediately getting into the face of someone so we can win our own one-on-one battles on the offensive glass. Or if you do get the defense rebound, you got someone in your face already. You don't get to just dribble the ball up the floor freely. You don't get the quick hit of heads. Or if you do, we got somebody back. It's fine. They've done such a good job of balancing that. Boston Celtics are good at it as well. And this just had my brain kind of churning all year long, Steve, about teams being able to balance that to that degree. And I'm just kind of wondering, are we going to see this continue? Are more teams going to be willing to send extra bodies to the offensive glass now because of their ability to kind of tag up and just lean more on that? I have some numbers on that front, but that's kind of the base thought that I had with offensive rebounding.
You know, and don't worry, Dunkers, I'm going to resist the urge to be an old coach at this current time. So don't worry, I got this. I think okay. What's fascinating about the evolution is it is a measure with the pace and the tempo of today's game to be able to say, hey, we're just going to go. You have to defend this, and then we're going to get back. And so that does kind of put a dent into some transition offense. Obviously, the goal is to score. So like offensive rebounding at its limitation, it's like, okay, I would prefer to score the ball than worry about crashing the glass. But I think it's interesting to see how teams have adjusted, especially when you think about Boston, Phoenix. Teams are just like, hey, you have to think about this, and how that wears on teams over the course of a game, where now we're not necessarily getting the same looks that we usually get when we do get a stop. And so I think that portion is almost more valuable than the rebound itself sometimes, because it's a mindset, the teams that commit to it. To where, you know, if we get a stop, we're getting out and running. Are you? Who's running? Who's there? We're taking away throw aheads because they had to try and box someone out. And if they don't box someone out, we get an extra chance at it. So it is an interesting concept. Ideally, again, you would probably prefer to score the basketball. Because everyone talked about Houston's offensive rebounding, right? And then Houston shot like 22% from three for like 2 weeks, and no one talked about offensive rebound. So I'm not sure, but I'm intrigued.
That's, I would say it's probably helpful that Houston was still able to get their own misses, because they had a lot of them during that stretch when they missed all of those threes. But to like the general numbers, across the leagues, the league average for offensive rebound rate, which is just the percentage of misses that your team grabs, is 29.1% per clean the glass. That is the highest number that we've seen since the 2012-2013 season. There are 11 teams right now in the league as of recording that has an offensive rebound rate of 30 or more. There were 12 teams back in that 12-13 season that did the same thing. And then what really fascinated me, like, who are the teams that are balancing both, to the earlier point? Who's getting those extra opportunities? Who's also limiting transition? Talked a little bit about it already, but Boston seems to be the gold standard. They are seventh in offensive rebound rate. They're third in transition frequency allowed, so you don't get the run on them. And even when you do, they're sixth in transition points per possession allowed. And I think for a team like Boston that already doesn't turn the ball over, we've talked about that when we did our breakdown on them, they're getting up a bunch of threes. They don't turn the ball over. When they do miss shots, they're grabbing a high percentage of their own misses. Like, it's such an effective formula to win the possession battle, which is becoming even more important as the NBA continues to evolve. And that's where I'm just kind of like, how many teams can truly tap into this? Like, how many can thread that needle? Because it's not an easy thing to do. Like, if everyone could do it, everyone would do it. You have to have the personnel. You have to have the mindset. You have to have the coaching. On top of that, that's where you salute Jordan Ott and you salute Joe Mazzulla and others. But, yeah, that's where I'm just like, this is fascinating that these are teams that are effectively doing both right now. We're not letting you get the easy stuff, and we're also getting extra bites at the apple. So I wanted to start because I've always thought.
I'm glad you're fascinated by that. Now, can I ask you a question, Nikas?
Sure.
Where are you at with pick and roll in today's NBA? Are you going to sell me that it's not a thing anymore?
I'm not going to sell you that it's not a thing anymore. I know how much you've loved the conversation about the Miami Heat and last year about the Memphis Grizzlies. And I'm sure next year there'll be another team that's like, hey, what if we replace these pick and rolls with something else? I will say it is noteworthy that pick and roll volume, if we're just looking at like picks per 100 possessions, it is the lowest that it's been in about a decade, Steve. This is five straight seasons in which the league average in terms of pick and rolls per game or pick and rolls per 100 possessions has gone down. And so there is a trend. I'll also note that Memphis last year, with how crazy low they were, Miami this year with how crazy low they are, that does skew the numbers a little bit in terms of the dip. But the trend itself has been going down the last few years. I think that's where you've seen more of the clear outs, more of the elbow work, more handoffs in particular. You've talked quite a bit about pass and cut and the rise of that. And ultimately that team should do more of that to kind of replace pick and rolls, but still get similar advantages. So, yeah, we are seeing fewer pick and rolls. I think that is now how real you think that trend is. You know, that is the eye of the beholder, but that is a thing that's happening. But with the pick and rolls that are being ran, there are a couple of things that intrigue me, but let me let you jump back in. But yeah,
I was going to say real quick, when it comes to the pick and roll volume, it's tricky because pick and roll is always going to be, I don't want to say a crutch because that sounds like rude, but it's going to be something you're going to lean on because you potentially are going to be able to create an advantage out of it and you can always flow into it. Me, myself, I think pace and tempo and the amount of teams that are willing to get up and down the court and let it fly can alter that as well as teams that are leaning into drive and kick. I think more teams need to get to pitch action, chase action, pass and cut action, get action, whatever you want to call it, get some of the same value from pick and roll without necessarily handing the defense the answers to the test. But I it's interesting because I think feel like conceptually teams want to get away from it to a degree, but because of what it, you know, it's going to create, it's hard to sit down to coach's meeting at 8:30 in the morning with a cup of coffee and not say we should put this person in action or we should guarantee we get two on the ball against this player.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's been the fascinating thing. We zoom out the last decade or so because teams are switching more than they ever have. I think that's probably where some of the, hey, do we need to run as much pick and roll as we are if teams are just going to flatten us out and switch the action anyway? To your point, there's obviously a mismatch honey element to all of this, and you really see that pop late in games. But through the run of the game, the first three quarters, there's just a level of flow that we want to get to. We want to have defensive scrambling. Can we find another avenue to get to on the ball, to your point? And so I think that's where some of that is coming in. Now, as we're talking about pick and rolls, two things that are fascinating me, Steve. One makes sense, which is the natural progression of three-point shooting and things. But how high pick and rolls are being run on average is as high as it's been, continues to grow. We're flirting with about 26 feet at this point on average pick and rolls. There are four or five teams that are averaging, you know, have an average pick and roll distance of about 27 feet, so about 3 feet behind the three-point line. You have the Los Angeles Clippers. James Harden runs quite a bit of those. Kawhi Leonard also running those. Also, quick shout out to Kawhi, who's just been excellent during this Clippers run. And he is just taking an ungodly amount of pull-up threes for him and knocking them down at a high clip. Not going to do a full Clippers breakdown again right now, but we see you. 15-3, hashtag eat the tweet, etc. The Boston Celtics are up there. Peyton Pritchard, Jaylen Brown, all those guys can initiate. They have very – you know, I'm Vic. Fan of Spain pick and roll, stat pick and roll, whichever one you want to call it, the many variants that they have, a lot of fun there. The Los Angeles Lakers, they have Luka Doncic, that makes sense. Tyrese Maxey, the Philadelphia 76ers, that makes sense. Jalen Brunson with the Knicks. Phoenix Suns, get well soon, Devin Booker, but a lot of different initiators, they run there as high on the floor as well. So you're seeing higher pick and rolls paired with some of the spacing tweaks that teams are getting to. And I think they are still finding ways, even with the volume overall being down, they're still finding ways to generate good advantages offensively. And that kind of flows into some of the dunker spot usage, which shout out to the podcast very quickly. But about 16% of pick and rolls ran this year have included someone spacing in the dunker spot. That is the highest rate that we've seen in the league since the 2017-18 season, Steve. This is the first time that we've seen at least 10 pick and rolls per 100 possessions with someone in the dunker spot since that 17-18 season as well. And this is where I have fun with how teams are utilizing that. Because I think on a very baseline level, we've talked a lot about flat spacing. You've laughed at me for calling it flat spacing. But we have a guy that we trust with the ball in his hands. We want to clear a whole bunch of space and make it difficult for you to send the extra bodies. So you have that. Also, to tie in the offensive rebounding point, we have another guy near the rim. If there is a pull-up three taken or pull-up midi taken or some kind of post-up shot taken, we probably have a body there to help crash the offensive glass. This is where you have your Houstons and where you have, you know, Detroit sprinkling in and other teams like that, to where we have that benefit. But some of the counts that we're seeing, Cleveland, when they have, you're going with their double big alignment, you have a similar bit, the offensive rebounding value, Evan Mobley, very good short roll passer, Jared Allen, also a very good short roll passer. You have that inherent value, but you also have some of the secondary flow that you can get out of that with Cleveland, to where Jared Allen can kind of float around, change sides. He has short hook shots if he needs them. And if you are now sinking in to try to help on some of those rotations, now you have pin-in opportunities on the weak side. You have difficult decisions to make if you are now the lowest player on the floor. Am I dropping down to Jared Allen? Do I need to stay with mine on the corner in the wing? Are we generating open threes because of that now? And so Cleveland does a really good job of stressing out defenses with that alignment as well. Like, I just love how teams are kind of playing around with that.
I think it's funny that everyone said they were done with the 90s, and we're loving 90s spacing where Big is at the block and trying to figure out how to find space and Snake and Flash. I think the more interesting, like, to add to what you've said, it's intriguing the amount of players that teams will put in the dunker spot. And so you're preying on defenses' rotations, what they want to do, but you're also putting a wing or a guard there because guards are typically not down there often. So it's a different rotation for them. So you're trying to exploit the defense and make their rotations not as compact or consistent as we've seen in the past. So it's just kind of a way where if we have two bigs, yeah, you're going to help up on the roll, or if you don't help up, I have a shot. We can play with each other. It's a guard, your natural instinct is going to be to help. And if you help up, we have an opening. So I think it's one of those things where the evolution is just trying to poke at defenses and what they want to do and putting different people in different positions.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, Steve. So it's been fun. Again, overall rate this year is up. There are 7 teams. They're running at least 20% of their pick and rolls with someone in the dunker spot right now. Philadelphia, who we talked about, which quick shout out to their fours who can crash the offensive glass, but also they'll dive and then go back out to the corner. You can get into some quick pitches and secondary action there. and not only that, like, they flow all over the place. Like with Jared Allen, you talk about Cleveland, like, it's mostly they're roaming the baseline. They're going from side to side, that's fine. Or you have the middle flash. With the Philly bigs, they'll do that. They'll also loop up to the three-point line sometimes for them to have an attack or flow into another handoff there. Like, we've talked a little bit about the Tyrese Maxey, Joel Embiid partnership and how you have some of the early action with them, but then it's a pitch back. They get into that as well. And then you also have the benefit of, again, if you're sinking down, this just turns into a pin in. We got somebody in the corner in the wing now. We can really poke at some matchups there. So I really enjoy how Philly's been able to do that. Charlotte's another team, high dunker spot usage. Nobody on a per 100 possessions basis is doing it more than them this year. Houston with Amen Thompson, which I still had the possession in the Milwaukee game earlier this year, burned in my brain, where Amen Thompson is just literally everywhere on the possession. It's like an early pick and roll. He dives, cuts to the dunker spot. It's a corner three for Jabari Smith Jr. He misses. Amen's there, gets an offensive rebound, kicks it out, and then he's still lurking the baseline as the opposition goon has the ball. And then he eventually gets a basket out of it. I'm just like, you know, you always have to keep an eye on that guy. But Houston, obviously very good, best offensive rebounding team in the league. So, again, you have that benefit there. So they're up there. The Cavs are also up there. They have been the most efficient team in the NBA on dunker spot pick and rolls. The Phoenix Suns, who we've talked about with their offensive rebounding. The Miami Heat is an interesting one because they just very rarely run pick and roll. But when they do, since they already have this baseline level of we're cutting from the wing and kind of flowing there, and they also mix in their guards and wings down there, Andrew Wiggins, Pelé Larsen, et cetera, they'll do it. And then naturally Denver, which we just want them to get healthy, though they've been very good with Nikola Jokic out so far. Want them to get healthy. We still miss Aaron Gordon roaming around there. It's not enough dunker spot, but enough dunker spot talk right now in terms of the actual basketball.
No. I would correct you. There's never enough dunker spot, and there's going to be more dunker spot talk. After we take this break, stick with us for more dunker spot talk.
And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. And Steve, let's talk about some teams that are making us think. Some teams that are making us go, Some teams with some rather big questions right now. And so we'll start again with you, sir. What team is top of mind for you right now?
The number one team at the top of my mind is the Orlando Magic. Because what's happening here? What's going on? You've lost 6 of your last 10 games. You have fallen to the 8th seed. And by falling to the 8th seed, you are a half game ahead of the Chicago Bulls, and you are a game and a half ahead of the Atlanta Hawks. This was not the vision that you were looking for going into this year. I know it's been a lot of injuries, which I think is honestly probably the biggest factor to where we haven't seen the flow. And I've been high on the Magic for the majority of the season. I think they did a good job of trying to embrace more offensive pace, trying to have more flow, trying to attack and be consistent on that end. Defensively, still kind of maintaining some of that base, but we're reaching an inflection point where, hey, are both sides of this going the wrong way? Are we losing the belief in our offense? Are we losing the pace and the tempo? Are we settling into bad habits? Are we playing slower than we need to? And defensively, can we not hit these high levels anymore? Are we not that team anymore? Can we not put paws on people and keep bodies in front and be that? Which one is it? Because we talk about a winning formula, right, Nikias? So we talk about what makes a team good, what makes a team great, how do they improve, what do they do better? Where is that with Orlando right now? Which side is it? Which side do you trust? What are they bringing to the table that tells you that this should be the team that we've seen? Again, injuries have played a factor because we have not seen Franz and Paolo together consistently for a very long time. But even when they're back in the lineup, are you trusting that defense? Are you trusting the combinations? Do you feel like it's good? I had Orlando as a playoff sleeper because of those two and the pressure they can put on teams, because of the defense that should elevate in the playoffs. But you're now putting yourself in a position where you're going to have to fight to earn the right to face Boston or Detroit. Now, it is the Eastern Conference, and I'm sure you're not afraid of either of them. But at a certain point in time, you got to elevate it. We got to feel good about it. They're 9-12 on the road, Nikias. Mm-hmm. They have less road wins than the Charlotte Hornets.
Respect the Charlotte Hornets. That's all I'll say. And I do. Time. Respect the Charlotte Hornets.
I do, but like you're fading in the background. Now, and I contrast it with Cleveland, right? We've had tons of questions about the Cleveland Cavaliers, tons of questions, tons of trying to figure out what their journey is. A lot of where are they going to land? They're in the 5 seed, knocking on the door of the 4 seed. They're 2 games behind Boston. This is a scenario where Cleveland could end up having the self awareness to gut through a season where you haven't felt good about them, and you look up and they're the 2 seed. And that changes mm-hmm. the story. So if I'm Orlando, hey, Orlando, you got to get on your horse right now, or else you're going to be in danger.
Yeah, I just say very quickly, I'm so excited to talk about Cleveland soon. They have been one of my favorite teams to watch as of late after what has been a tumultuous season for them from a health perspective. But we'll save that for a later date, I promise. To the Orlando Magic bit, one, I'm right there with you. Like, which side of this do you believe in? And more pressing than that, Steve, as you sift through some of these post-game comments from the last few games, how much do the players believe in any of this is becoming a bigger and louder question surrounding the Orlando Magic. This has been a whole lot of, say, hey, Jamal Mosley, what's going on with this offense? Yeah, we got to get the defense together. Hey, Paolo, what do you think's happening? I mean, we've always been a really good defense and the offense is inconsistent. Like, we, you know, this is what we've been. It's like, I don't know if I like hearing things of the sort like that. I'm not going to hold you. That combined with the health thing is where it's just like, what's going to be the factor? What is the get right game that gets this, forget just being better, what gets this feeling better? What gets the spirits lifted in this group? Because it just feels like it's like a cloud over Orlando right now.
I have an easy answer. It's winning. Winning usually cures everything. But this is the flip side of continuity. This is the tough part of continuity. You are battling your own demons. You are battling your own issues. You are battling patterns. You are trying to figure out how to avoid the thing that has hurt you in the past. And if you look at this stretch, you give up 126 to Memphis. You give up 124 to Charlotte. You give up 119, 114 to Cleveland in a 3-day span. You can't survive like that. So you've got to recommit to playing defense. So I understand what Jamal Mosley is saying. It's like, our defense has to hit a certain level for us to have success. I understand what Paolo is saying in the sense that, yeah, our defense has always been our bread and butter. Our offense has always been shaky. But the offense isn't necessarily going to boost it. But scoring sub 100 in 2 of the last 3 games that you've played isn't ideal. And so that's where my concern is, like, if the offense is going to slip backwards and the defense is also going to slip backwards, what are you? Who are mm-hmm. you? You have lost both of your identities. You are sitting there. Your phone is in low battery mode and you have no food right now.
What a combination of words there. But like, that's what has me kind of concerned, Steve, as someone that was also very high on Orlando heading into the season. Said this on this podcast, said on the warm-up, etc. Like, I like the makeup of this group. And I think this is where trust really comes in and kind of how things are being translated. Because from Jamal Mosley's standpoint, to kind of hang there for a little bit, it's very much we need the defense to be this. And like, this is our formula to winning. And it feels like, again, my interpretation, I'm not reporting anything, yada, yada. But like, just kind of reading the feel of Orlando right now, going back to the Paolo side, it's less the defense needs to hit a certain level. And for Paolo, it feels like he's saying like, yeah, our defense has been good. Like, that's been a crutch for us because this offense has always been this. And it's just like, it's not super different, but that's enough of a difference in how this is coming across or how this is feeling in the locker room to where I am concerned that, hey, if they don't, to your point, win some games to get the mood better or tweak some things, this could be a little bit of a spiral, or what could constitute as a spiral in the Eastern Conference at the very least. That's why I'm saying I need to see this. And for Paolo in particular, who has been in and out of the lineup, he's been part of the health woes for Orlando. But also, hey, Paolo, we need you to drive more. Hey, Paolo, stop taking jumpers. He stops taking jumpers. Hey, Paolo, why aren't you taking jumpers? He takes jumpers. Hey, Paolo, you missing all these jumpers. And it's just like, okay, well, cool, we're going to pass. We like to pass, and we need you to score, though, because we're missing people. I think there's been a lot of that around Paolo, too. And so, hey, something's got to turn.
Hey, I just want the world to know Paolo Banchero is a lot better than you give him credit for, and that should be said and screamed from the rooftops. I'll leave it there. Nikias, okay. What other teams are making you think, making you ask questions? Who else shall we discuss?
Okay. Well, while we're in kind of the somber what's going on here mood, I will start with the Milwaukee Bucks. Full transparency, like I don't really want to talk about the Milwaukee Bucks right now because like the situation is making me sad. And I've tweeted it recently. Like, it stinks that Bucks fans have to deal with, like, one, just the up and downs of the season. Giannis has been in and out of the lineup. He's out again with a calf strain. Like, that part just stinks. And then you have all of the trade swirlings and things that have just been pretty consistent since, what, 2019? What was it? The Bucks elimination against Toronto, I want to say. And, like, 20 minutes later, it's an article drop about Giannis' future. Like, so this has just been a longstanding thing. I don't think it helps now that, like, Giannis is asked in a post game, like, are you going to be with the Bucks post All-Star break? I don't know. It's like, that doesn't feel great. And I'm never going to ask for a trade. And a little bit later, it's like, hey, you never know. Something might change tomorrow. Like, that stuff isn't helping. So, like, all that just kind of stinks. Giannis being out stinks. The Bucks without Giannis have largely stunk. And so now it just kind of leads to this bigger picture of, like, what exactly do the Bucks need to do about this? Like, I hate to add to the is it time to trade Giannis bit, but if he is starting to sound less committal than he has been, and ultimately just is not on the court at this point, if you are at the tail end of the play-in picture, I do just kind of wonder at what point Milwaukee says, actually, we may just have to recoup assets. We may just have to rip the Band-Aid off versus relying on this group or making another aggressive swing for someone in the good player, bad contract division to try to hold serve while Giannis recovers from yet another calf strain or just another lower body injury that continues to stack with him. Like, I'm just getting kind of scared for the Bucks right now. Cause like, this situation isn't trending very well.
Understood. So you contribute to the Hot Take Express. Not wanting to. I appreciate that. I don't want to talk about trading Giannis, but boy, they should trade Giannis.
Not even that. It's just like, hey, it's just getting dice. I don't know, man. I don't like where they're at right now. Like, the defense shouldn't look like this. Like, Doc Rivers does not seem pleased. If you are on any social media containing Bucks fans, they are certainly not pleased with Doc Rivers. And we have seen similar sentiments towards the end of his tenures in different spots. And so it's just like all of this is just feeling kind of yucky. And I just hate that as a basketball fan. So I guess I want to start there just to get it out of the way. Can I get into something that actually excites me right now? Some positive.
I have no Bucks thoughts. No disrespect. Okay, fair enough. So go ahead. What you got?
All right. We'll start with the Eastern Conference. So, Steve, the Toronto Raptors continue to be very good at basketball.
Oh, we're so back.
We are fresh off of a 4-1 road trip for them where Scotty Barnes, multiple clutch stops, big win against the Oklahoma City Thunder recently. Emmanuel Quickley has just turned his season around. And like that just feels like one of the more underrated subplots in the Eastern Conference right now. And is coming off of an Eastern Conference Player of the Week selection. So salute to him real quick. My broader thought with the Toronto Raptors as they sit in the 3 seed as of recording and are knocking on the door of the 2 seed currently held by the Boston Celtics. I have enjoyed, one, the Scottie Barnes experience. Two, the Colin Murray Boyles experience. We'll have a little bit more on him shortly. And three, the Scottie Barnes plus Colin Murray Boyles on the floor together experience. The Raptors have not had Jakob Poeltl since, I think, December 20th or December 21st. And they have won a lot of games since then. And so I think looking forward, Scottie plus Colin Murray Boyles, like that's a lot of defensive versatility. That's a lot of playmaking, a lot of short roll talent, et cetera. I just wonder like what the general belief level is from Toronto ownership right now. And when looking at the big man room, it's like, do we wait on Jakob Poeltl to get healthy and hope that he adds to this group? Because when he, you know, generally during his Toronto tenure, when he's been healthy, the screening, the passing, some of the defense, it has been valuable for them. They've just been a better team with him on the floor. That contract isn't great though. And if we're talking about back stuff for a center, like that obviously isn't great. So if you're the Raptors and you're in this top four range, do we make a swing for another big? Like they've been linked to Domantas Sabonis and Anthony Davis on the super high end. I don't know if they want to do that. Do they go for like a moderate big upgrade so they have a true center that gives them more of a bridge to some of the Scottie plus Colin Murray Boyle stuff? And I'm saying this while Mamu has still played very well for them and has been one of my favorite reserves in the league. I just kind of wonder like how aggressive they think they should be or will be heading into the deadline. Because this is a good group. I also worry about those two guys defending center, true centers for like extended stretches and then heading into the playoffs, especially if Jakob Poeltl isn't there. Like, do they have another counterpunch on that front? So I'm just kind of wondering like where their head's at right now.
Well, I mean, it may be time in this Eastern Conference to go ahead and roll the dice and try and push all the chips in and see what you can do. I mean, they've believed in what they're trying to build by getting Brandon Ingram, by getting RJ Barrett, by getting Emmanuel Quickley. And it's interesting, your question marks have now been answered. Emmanuel Quickley, once again, reminding you of what and why the Raptors went ahead and got him. But there's one name I'm not sure you mentioned this much, and that's RJ Barrett. And I believe, if I did quick math, as you were talking about the Raptors, they're 18-7 with him in the lineup this year. And if you push this past, like if you go to just to Halloween on, right? Just from Halloween on, they're 17-3, if I did my math right, with RJ Barrett in the lineup. It's kind of nuts. I'll let the production staff yell at me if I got that wrong, because I kind of quickly. But they have a formula, they have a blend. And I think the issue for me is less the traditional center part. I think Jakob Poeltl is very good. It's unfortunate he's been injured. Do you want to get a big that replaces that so you can have a big that helps your team and keeps your movement up and you can also go small? Probably. I think that'd be the ideal setting. The issue for me is you don't want to get into a scenario where you vision this again and now we have to play small ball to have success. And now teams are like, cool, we're going to switch. And now you don't have the same impact with it. The key is you want to have lineups that are impactful in different moments, in different scenarios, against different teams. And I think that's the key for Toronto. So I don't necessarily think they have to have a traditional center, but I think they need to have a dynamic where they have two things at one time, where they can give you different looks defensively, where offensively they can have different staggered lineups and have guys that are having impactful moments at different times. That's the key for them. But they've done what they're supposed to do, and they've kind of just been able to navigate and fight through different parts of the season. Their game has traveled, Nikias. Who has the most road wins in the Eastern Conference, Nikias?
Based on the setup, would this be the Toronto Raptors?
Toronto Raptors, 16-9. So,
how about that?
I mean, you probably would like for that to translate to your home arena, but this is something where you can keep the belief, you can keep the buy-in. And again, the Eastern Conference is competitive, so why not? Why can't we beat Boston? Why can't we get the 2 seed? Why can't we roll the dice and win this thing?
Yeah, I got you. Like, it's just the Jakob thing is naturally unfortunate, but it's also like if we are trading for a traditional center because Jakob Poeltl isn't healthy, like ideally you want to include him in the deal because of what the contract is. But because of the contract and the health status, like you probably have to attach something, and then that just gets complicated. And just in general, if I am trading for a quote-unquote traditional big, like, he kind of needs to be as good or better than Mamu, or as good or better than Colin Murray-Boyles to make sense. Because otherwise, like, if I'm trading for a big that isn't as good as any of those guys, then, like, why am I adding them if we could just play those other guys? You know what I mean? So it's an interesting needle thread. But shout out to what the Raptors are doing. Scottie Barnes and Emmanuel quickly continue to play well. As you mentioned, RJ Barrett has been pretty impactful and important for them pretty much all year long. Other thoughts, but we'll save them for later. Is there another team? Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say real quick, DeMontis bonus time.
Hmm.
Hmm. 15 letters, two words.
We're going to yeet to the Rising Stars announcement. I'll just give the quick thing. Like, I had some Thunder late game offense thoughts. I will save those. 0-3 in their last three clutch games, and 84 offensive rating.
You don't want to talk about it?
Like, yes and no. But I think for me, because, like, the Thunder have generally just been good in clutch games this year, so I'm not trying to, like, in clutch stats in general are already super small sample, so I don't want to react to overreact to an even smaller sample. I guess the intrigue for me has just been going to the Miami game and the Toronto game in particular. How OKC is looking to get Shea the ball in the coverages that Shea is seeing. Miami was like, cool, we'll just switch all this stuff. And if you poke at a matchup, then we're just showing a whole bunch of help behind it. Not necessarily a new thing, but kind of the audaciousness of some of the help that Shea was seeing was like, huh, teams are really daring these other guys to beat them because of how good Shea is. I was like, okay, that's intriguing. Then we get to the Toronto game, Steve, which, heck of a win. Scottie Barnes getting the block on Chet Holmgren to close things out. Chet Holmgren taking that shot to begin with or something, but we'll leave that there. But anyway, we get to the Toronto game, Steve. And it is Jacoby Walter saying, I am just guarding Shea no matter where he is. We'll do full court pressure. It does not matter if you're trying to work off ball. I am in your jersey. You're not going to have fun. And then Shea gets the ball. It's like, all right, cool. He tries to attack. Here are three Raptor jerseys in the vicinity whenever Shea tried to do anything. And we'll also mix in some traps and some double teams on top of that. Strong side help, we'll send that because we don't want you to get comfortable. And it's like, on one hand, again, overall this year, the Thunder have been a very good clutch offense. I think they're third in clutch offensive rating this year. So again, I don't want to hit that too hard because they've largely been good. But the audaciousness that we're seeing with some of the help decisions is where I'm just like, huh, how much of this is we are really locked into Shea? How much of this is we know y'all don't have the full healthy assortment right now? Jalen Williams is out again. I'm just, you know, just kind of keeping that in the back of my mind right now because it has just been a weird stretch for them. Like, they've lost back-to-back games. We don't really see that with the Thunder super often. So it's where I was like, huh, this has been interesting. I'm keeping eyes on it.
Well, I think a couple things. One, I think the absence of Jalen Williams gets felt in those moments of those games because if you look at the alignment that they had, usually Jalen Williams is one pass away when it's clutch time. And we're going to make a decision. We're going to make you make a decision. So if you're going to commit to this help, it's a quick kick to Jalen Williams, who either make that shot or keep the advantage. Now it's about being more decisive, I feel like. And so one of the things that has elevated Shea is his ability to, it doesn't actually matter about what your one-on-one coverage. I'm going to find my spot. I'm going to get to my shot, and I'm going to make you pay and make you not feel good about it. Toronto was just saying, absolutely not. And I think for Shea, it was like, okay, I don't want to say he made the wrong reads, but the timing of them, okay, did you overexplore the penetration? They got good looks as you put together, but did you overexplore it? And now it's, okay, we're fine living with that. And, you know, part of the balance is, okay, how often can you live with that if they knock down shots? Because that's a hard thing to deal with. Totally. But,
yeah,
you know, if you drove and you knew the help was coming, you just kick it to the corner. Okay, did you have an opportunity to maybe take a shot there? Like, and it's real nitpicky because Shea's been very good. And Toronto was just saying, not you, anyone but you, everyone but you. But in those moments, do you get to where you're playing a little too slow? Do you get off the ball too quick? How do you navigate and get the right mix there? So I think that's probably the most interesting thing. But I wanted to make sure you got that in because you've been very correct about the Thunder concerns, and then they popped up. So it's interesting to see, especially with the Denver Nuggets knocking on the door.
Yeah.
We're gonna go ahead and take this two seed. And by the way, don't worry about Nikola Jokic. Don't worry about him. He's fine. We'll see him in a little bit.
He'll be back soon.
He'll be back soon. So we're coming. Like that's the threat to me. If you're Oklahoma City, Denver putting themselves in a position where, hey, could we knock on the door of the one seed? Could we tap on that real quick? Also, that means we're done. We're done with history talk, right? We're done with the story. We're done with that. We're done. We can call it.
Well, I mean, they still have the point differential. They're not going to get to the wins though. So, like, you know, the Warriors are saved. The Bulls are saved. So, like, that part is not, they are still incredibly good. As you mentioned, it's kind of nitpicky, but we're seeing it. Can I ask you a quick free throw, Steve, before we transition to the Rising Stars?
Absolutely.
How good are the Lakers?
The Lakers are a very good team with very clear flaws. I think that's where I've been with the Lakers, which is why I've kind of tried to say that every time we talk about the Lakers. But they have Luka Doncic, who remains to play insane. They have LeBron James, who's a super cute computer offensively. The defense is just where it's going to be. They have to find a way to mask and keep pressure on teams and figure it out. They're going to switch. They're not going to track. They're not going to be a team that's constantly in rotation. They're going to switch. They're going to try and keep it in front. They're going to try and dictate their rotations. They're going to try and show help early on driving lanes. Sometimes it looks really, really good. Sometimes it looks really, really bad. And it's just going to be on them to figure out, okay, what can we live with? How much can we contain this? Can we live with this? Can we mix in more zone at times? We've seen that be effective. We've also seen it not be effective. We've seen drop be effective. We've seen it not be effective. They have to get their defense to a spot where they can at least navigate or pick their poison. And this, to me, could be helped by a playoff game plan where we're doing these very specific things against this very specific team, as opposed to a regular season defense that has a strong base that you can carry night in, night out. Some nights it looks really good and they are able to hold teams, keep the ball in front, get out and run. Offense is superpowered. Sometimes the offense is superpowered, so the defense doesn't matter as much. But the Lakers are who they are. It's going to be matchup based, and it's going to be how well does that defense perform? How do they build the habits? How do they build the belief to defend as a team? That is the Lakers bit. That's it. That's not a team you want to see in the playoffs, but that's a team that has to figure it out defensively if they want to knock on any doors. That's just what it is.
It is. I think that's all fair. Like, it's just, they're just firmly, well, I guess I can't say firmly because of how tight the standings are in the Western Conference, but they are just in the top six. They continue to rack up wins. They have been essentially the best clutch team in basketball this year. I think they are 14-2 as of recording in clutch games this year and 10-2 in the Luka games in particular. And so it's just like the offense is very good. It's not top five right now, but it's very good. The defense is not very good. But to your point about what the formula is, they need the defense to hold up well. If they get you to a close game, they do have Luka and LeBron and, when healthy, Austin Reeves. And, like, they do just have a way to generate advantages. And so, for me, it's just trying to decide, like, on one hand, they're fifth in the Western Conference. On the other hand, looking at their point differential, I'm just like, well, this doesn't seem to profile as a team that should be this good. I look at their offense, like, okay, this is good. This defense is kind of eh. Now, look at the other teams in the West. It's like, well, I probably feel better about Minnesota. Probably feel better about Houston. They have flaws, but, like, I feel better about both of them. The Nuggets are playing well right now, and, like, they don't have Jokic right now. The Spurs have, like, it's weird. I'm just kind of in a weird place with them because, like, they are good, but, like, there's obvious upside for them to be even better, to your point about a playoff game plan. And then it's also, like, I'm looking at the quote-unquote resume, and it's like they don't match up to these other teams that they are in a similar standing with. So it's just been – I just wanted to ask you, get your thoughts on that.
Well, no, I just think depending on your basketball sensibilities, right? They're either the easiest team to buy into or they are the easiest team to sell on because, okay, they can't guard anybody. I'm done with them. They have Luka and LeBron. I'm all in on them. There's gray area in between. But I think because the defense can be so loud, you can just be like, nope, not them. But because when the offense has it going and Luka and LeBron and Austin Reeves are playing at a certain high level, nope, they can do it. And so I just think you get stuck in those two avenues. And the real meat and potatoes of it is they need lineup versatility to be able to navigate through matchups. They have to be able to execute different coverages. If they can do that, they have a shot against anyone. If they cannot, we have seen it with our eyes. It doesn't look great. And I think that's the knowledge they all have in that locker room.
There we go. All right. That's fair. All right, Steve. The Rising Stars were announced yesterday as we record. And so we have the pool of rookies in alphabetical order. We have Cedric Howard of your Memphis Grizzlies. We have Yegor Jeoman of the Brooklyn Nets. We have VJ Edgecombe of the Philadelphia 76ers. Jeremiah Fears of the New Orleans Pelicans. Cooper Flagg of the Dallas Mavericks. You might have heard of him. Dylan Harper of the Spurs. Trey Johnson of the Wizards. Con Knipple of the Hornets. Colin Murray-Boyles of the Raptors. And Derek Queen of the New Orleans Pelicans. Any surprises from the group of 10 for the Rising Stars player pool?
No surprise, especially we went over our rookie of the year talk. I think we had the majority of these names in that discussion. Mm-hmm. I think Trey Johnson is someone who's deserving. You know, I've had Caleb Love higher, but Trey Johnson's been a bucket for the majority of the year, and he's gotten better, especially as he's gotten more reps with the playmaking. So no real surprises for me. How about you?
No real surprises, and honestly, like, no firm complaints. Like, if you told me that, I don't know, like, there are a couple of names, I guess. Like, if, like, Ryan Kaltbrenner was in for one of the other spots, I would be like, oh, okay, I understand how you get there. I wouldn't have been mad at that. But, like, I think this is a pretty firm list. Like, this is one of the rare times where I looked at one of these, like, all-star announcements, rising star announcements, whatever, where there isn't a very obvious how the heck did you not have this guy. Like, you mentioned Caleb Love. Firm argument that you could have him in. Ryan Kaltbrenner, if he was healthier, could have had a firm argument. And a few other guys that you could sprinkle in. Will Richard for Golden State, I think he's been a very impactful rookie. If he was in instead of, like, Trey Johnson, I wouldn't have been mad at that. I would have understood Trey Johnson complaints, but that would have been, you know, that would have been fine. So, honestly, I think it was just a job well done. Kind of feel for Ace Bailey, as we talked about him on the last episode. But, like, even then, like, am I mad that he's not in? Like, no, because there are 10 other deserving rookies at minimum. So I think it's a pretty solid job. Now let's get to the sophomore, Steve.
Yeah, that was the intrigue for me. I'm intrigued to see if there are any names that are missing from this list that you were intrigued by.
Yeah. So we got Matas Buzelis of the Chicago Bulls, Stephon Castle of the Spurs, Donovan Klingon of the Blazers, Keyshawn George of the Wizards, AJ Mitchell of the Thunder, Alex Sarr of the Washington Wizards, who's played very well, Reed Shepard in, Cam Spencer in, Jalen Tyson. Steve, this was the one that I was worried about. I thought he should just be an automatic because of how well he's played. The shooting, the cutting, the screening, defending, all the things. But, like, doesn't have the name. And, like, there are just other names and good sophomores in the league. And I was just very worried about, like, what that's going to look like. I was very prepared when I saw that the teams were going to be announced yesterday. I was very prepared to be yelled, to be mad and have a rant prepared. But he was in. And I was like, okay, thank goodness. We ain't got to worry about that. Khalil Ware's in. Jalen Wells is in. Now, in terms of, like, just name value, like, not seeing Zachary Richesche was an interesting one. It was like, huh, just, like, how often have we just not had the number one pick, like, non-health division? Even Neil, he is also working back from injury and stuff. Which, actually, can I go on, like, a 10-second rant?
Sure.
So, there's been understandable, like, concern about Richesche in Atlanta and him not popping to the degree of a normal number one pick, etc. And if you've been following the Atlanta Hawks, it's like, okay, when is he closing games? What do the fourth quarter minutes look like? How aggressive is he offensively? So there are things to, like, poke at with him. So I don't want to take that away from the basketball perspective. But I think because there are a lot of people that disagree with the pick outright, and then with some of the other performances that we've seen from this draft class, some of the stuff just kind of skews the wrong way. And then we had this bit where Richesche is out. And so, like, what teams like to do is, okay, cool, we're going to send you down to the G League assignments so you can practice with the G League team as you recover. And then we just call you back up and then you're essentially back in the lineup. And so there's the announcement that Richesche was sent down to the G League. And this turned into, man, y'all drafted that guy number one. He in the G League in year two. And I'm just like, I'm just like, why are we doing? Like, I understand, like, the internet is just the internet. You know what I mean? Like, it just comes with a level of toxicity and whatnot. But I'm just like, bro, why are we doing this? Not even a Twitter joke. It's just like there's, like, general misunderstanding about that. And I was like, why? Come on, we ain't got to do that.
Well, there's no There's no misunderstanding about who made the G League portion of this, Nikias. Would you like to tell the audience?
That's a tremendous shot from you. But yes, so for the G League squad, we have Sean East II. We have Young Hansen from the Portland Trailblazers. We have Ron Harper Jr. in the mix. We had to have both of the Harpers in, currently two-way for the Boston Celtics. David Jones Garcia, who lit it up during summer league for the San Antonio Spurs. Yannick Tonin Niederhauser, who gave the Clippers some interesting minutes while Zubac was out. Want to give him a quick highlight there. Elijah Barton of the Toronto Raptors, ridiculous defender already. Also does not mind mixing it up. If you remember our league pass game. And Tristan Newton, shout out UConn, of the Houston Rockets. But I guess going back to the sophomores, again, no Richey, like not a surprise, which like, huh, that's a big name missing. I think if Zach Edey was healthy, I think he's just very easily in. Trying to think, was there anyone that popped for you with the sophomore group? It was like, huh, why isn't this guy in?
I mean, probably Ron Holland, but I understand. Mm-hmm. I understand. The game is what it is, and I think it's just like availability. Like if Zach Edey was healthy, he'd probably be there.
Okay, yeah, I thought, yeah. Pretty much well done for me with the team selected. So those are my quick thoughts. Excited to see how those games play out. We're going to take a break. And when we return, we've got unrivaled thoughts because, buddy, what a weekend it was. Stay tuned. And we are back with this episode of The Dunker Spot. Steve, it is time to get unrivaled. Fun slate of games this weekend. Some big performances, some wild finishes, some ref complaints are starting to trickle in. I had some concerns heading into the weekend, and one of those games, we certainly got that. As I am recording, once again, in an undisclosed location in Miami, I was at the unrivaled games on Sunday and Monday, so that was fun for me. I think, one, because I have like some practice takeaways I want to get into stuff, I think broad takeaway for me from this weekend, Steve, Breanna Stewart, incredibly good at basketball. We knew this. And as you know, my main concern was, hey, what is this three-point shooting going to look like because of what the last couple of years have been and what last unrivaled season was? She's knocking those down. She's not shy about taking them. I was like, okay, we might just be here now. Because if we have the Stewie that's just taking the early threes in transition, knocking down the spot-up looks, in addition to Stewie as a screener, Stewie as an initiator, Stewie on the offensive glass, random Stewie cuts, and then defensively she can guard everyone and execute multiple coverages on top of that, it's like, ah, she's just back to being a world destroyer. And you kind of saw that in all of the missed matchups. So I was like, huh, Breanna Stewart, probably the big story for me.
Here's the thing. We're going to get to your takes because you were there. We want to dive into all the wonderful content that you produced and get that out there. But it's always funny to me that you always say Stewie is back. And it's just like, no, she's just missing threes. All the other stuff still is there. And you saw how
you saw how
it elevated the Misties, which, by the way, incredible alternate uniforms from the the alternate uniforms have been great. About to open up a webpage, spend some money. But I think with Stewie, it's just she's such a force, and you can use her in so many different ways, especially in 3-on-3. And if it's, if you're the Mist, it's one of those things where they have such a good balance offensively with Stewie playing at that level. And we can have Alicia Gray, who's been outstanding this entire time, and no one's really been able to guard her. Veronica Burton knows her job. Lana Smith knows her job. Arike comes in and does what she does. And that's where my question becomes, are the Mist the most balanced team in Unrivaled? Because I'm leaning that way. I was going to ask the question, is it the Mist or is it the Rose? But I'm leaning towards the Mist right now.
I think it is the Mist. And honestly, if we're talking about just overall balance, like I don't know how heavily I factored the Rose into that conversation right now. Just because it has been, at least on the scoring front, it's been such a top-heavy ordeal for them so far this year. They have leaned on Chelsea Gray a lot. And as Kalia Copper has come back and has gotten back into the flow of things, she is certainly helping with that scoring production. But like one game, it might be Azaree Stevens knocking down shots and getting the drives going. And then she doesn't have it. One game, we may have Shakira Austin driving all over the place and getting buckets. And then she doesn't have it. So I think if we're talking about balance, the fact that, to your point, Alicia Gray, who's just been fantastic this entire run, right as she started coming off the bench. She is just back in the starting lineup, by the way. But Alicia Gray's been fantastic. Stewie's been fantastic. And now, to your point, Steve, the threes are kind of the cherry on top of everything that Stewie's already been doing. You get like a 20-point off the bench game from Arike in all this. Veronica Burton, her drive's been pretty consistent all season long, in addition to the defense. Like, they could just hit you in so many different ways with so many different players, with so many different actions. And you're just not having a good time trying to create against them. So, like, yeah, I think it is just the mist if we're talking about overall balance.
I think balance can mean a lot of different things to different people. You know, it can be the structure of your lineups, can be how many different lineups you can get to, can we do double big, can we have the scoring punch in different lineups. I think that's what the mist provides. Like, we can get buckets, we can be double big and defend you, we can do different things. Now, they have to apply it, and we've seen what happens when the scoring isn't there, the defense doesn't hit a certain level. I think they have the highest ceiling in theory. But it gets interesting, though, because we do have this Laces team that just refuses to stop competing. They just refuse to stop competing. It's just like, ooh, buddy, Alyssa Thomas, yeah. Jackie Young, yeah. Brittany Sykes, sneaky. If I rolled out a Brittany Sykes MVP candidacy, what would your reaction be?
I would understand it. Like, I think she has, one, she's just been very good all year long. But once you also factor in, you know, the minute count for Alyssa Thomas, especially over these last two or three games. Jackie Young, we barely saw her in the second half of the game last night. Asked Andrew Wade about her status after the game, said, no, she's going to be fine. She's going to be good. It's like, okay, that's cool. But yeah, Brittany Sykes has just been so consistently available and also good on both ends of the floor. Like, I wouldn't be mad at that. And the Laces, as recording, they're 6-1. They have the best record in the league. So if you were picking best player from best team, like, in a vacuum, do I think Brittany Sykes is better than Jackie or Alyssa Thomas? Like, I don't. But could you argue that she's been their best player this year? Absolutely.
It's I don't know if they're this without what she's done, in theory. Mm-hmm. Like, AT is AT, and Jackie Young has been incredible. But Brittany Sykes has been timely with just not only the bucket getting, but just the dog. And, like, that's what the Laces are. They just get after you, and, like, all of a sudden you get to – because Unrivaled is so different. It's three quarters. That third quarter is so important. And that fourth quarter, it's just – it's steel cage. It's time to get it down. And it's hard to beat the Laces in that fourth quarter if you haven't put them in a position in the first three. And it's hard to put them in a position in the first three because of who they have, on top of what Nas Hillman's done. So they've been really good. Now, what I did want to get to, obviously you were there, and you were able to have some conversations, practice, shoot around, pressers. What stood out to you the most? Because I think when people think of Unrivaled, right, it's easy to kind of stamp, oh, it's 3-on-3. But if you open the basketball brain, conceptually, there's more to it. It's easier in a sense, but yeah, there's more space on the floor. But conceptually, there's a balance of pace and tempo and execution, because we see teams running sets. It's not always just back and forth. What stood out to you the most as you were able to kind of just dig in and talk to players, talk to coaches?
I think for me, it was two things. I think one, as you kind of alluded to, the big lineups that teams can sprinkle in, like how these teams and how these coaches are trying to figure out their lineup combinations and like how much room they feel they have to explore different lineup combinations has been interesting to me. Like, getting to talk to Noel Quinn ahead of the Breeze matchup on Monday, I was just asking, just on a general note, you know, the samples are so much smaller. Like, this is a shorter season. The games are so much shorter. Like, if you're looking at lineup data, like, what is the threshold to, like, okay, I can believe in this lineup being, like, +5 or -5. It doesn't matter which one. But, like, what's your threshold for that? And then you factor in, like, they've had players in and out. Like, Rekia Jackson didn't play on Monday night, which, quick shout out to Rekia, who had a funny moment with Alyssa Thomas during the dead ball on the sideline. Kind of ran up on her. Like, they were obviously joking around and stuff. And I was like, oh, that's cool. And she's also just a very active teammate on the sideline. So, like, just want to give her a quick shout out there. But, like, getting into the lineup minutia was an interesting conversation that I had there. And Noel hinted at the fact that, you know, wasn't sure if Rekia was going to play or not. But I know people have been clamoring for me to play Dom and Cam together. We haven't got to that look yet. You know, we have some ideas about it. And then to see that lineup roll out on Monday night, it's like, oh, well, this is kind of terrifying. Which, very quickly, I know you have Dominique Malonga thoughts. The one thing I'll sprinkle in, keep an eye on her seals. she is looking more and more comfortable with smaller defenders on her and getting to looks that she wants versus kind of defaulting to some of these fadeaways that she can knock down, but are more like out of, you know, she's not doing it from a position of strength. If she's just bullying people on the offensive glass and also getting the shot she wants, that's just a scary prospect and unrivaled. And
oh, is it time? Because I thought you were going to dig more. Is it time to go to Breeze FC? Is it time?
No, just in about 15 seconds. In about 15 seconds. Okay. That part was interesting. And then, you know, to the spacing point in particular, I was really curious about how teams want to space in Unrivaled. And I was kind of curious about how often are teams filling the corners versus they want to have kind of things on the wings, things like that. And so talking to Noel Quinn about that and really just bounced around a bunch of coaches asking like how they go about that. That was some of my most fun conversation that I had over the weekend and on Monday in particular. Mm-hmm. It's like some teams are like, we tell our players never to fill the corners because you're not really in a position. You're kind of in no man's land on some of these possessions because we're not getting to those weak side kicks all the time. And ultimately, if you want to get into a secondary action, if you're all the way in the corner, it makes it harder for you to flow into that quickly. You're talking about an 18-second shot clock versus 24. And so we kind of want these on the wings. It's like, okay, that makes sense. But then you look at a team like the Breeze, that they don't mind filling their corners, especially when they're setting up, you know, Paige coming off ball with something. Or you look at Rose BC, where they'll go into these wide pin-downs with Kalia Kapa, who starts deep in the corner before flowing into those. So Nola Hillary had her own thoughts on that. And I was like, you know what? This is fascinating to me that we have these principles of where we want our players to space. We don't want the corners filled sometimes versus actually, if you start on the wing, you can then fill the corner later. We're fine with that, but we don't want you down there as a default. Some of this just like, actually, we just never want you. Like, it's, I had a lot of fun kind of digging into the minutia.
Oh, I know you did. I know you did. I resisted all the old coach urges to be like, it's 3-on-3. Because I think it's funny. You look at the Laces Breeze game, and both teams started out in that Spain stack pick and roll. The Laces had Jackie in the corner before she had the back screen. I think the one thing that gets interesting, it's a tough pass to make in 3-on-3 if you get an advantage. I thought it was funny. You asked Noel Quinn the question, and then the first play that she drew up in a timeout when they showed her on TV, the corner was filled. I was kind of laughing. I was like, that's kind of funny. But it's like it's tricky because, again, there's so much up and down play, but there are moments where you can try to manipulate scenarios, and you see moments where the wing is, you know, they start on the wing. If a drive comes that way, they fill that corner. So as opposed to staying in that corner in a clear space, start here, see if you help. I'm going to open up space by getting to the – it's a different type of game in the sense that you have to try and poke at teams in a different way. Like you would think, okay, it's 3-on-3. If we get 2 on the ball and pick and roll, it's an automatic. How often has it felt like that in Unrivaled? Anyone who's gotten 2 on the ball has been like, ooh, this is an adventure because it's not easy. You have to make the pass. The defense is helping. There's one person that knows their job. And so you can't necessarily exploit it like you would think you could in theory. And so it's been fascinating to kind of see you explore and get the answers to those questions.
Yeah, I appreciate that. That's where like the Chelsea playmaking and Kelsey Plum in particular getting 2 on the ball as often as she has so far this year has been fascinating, the track and what decisions she's making when getting those coverage. Steve, I will concede the floor to you because I know you have some Breeze BC thoughts from what you
saw. Is it time to talk about Breeze BC? Because, look, this team is fun, and I think that they have so much potential, especially on the defensive end, because you have to deal with Cam Brink and her rotations and her paint presence and her late switches, and I think she's been really, really nails at the timing. Like, I don't think she gets enough credit for that, but also Dom Malanga nailing some of those late switches, nailing some of that activity, being able to defend multiple positions. Like, I think that's the fun part of Unrivaled is you are allowed to kind of just put yourself in a different position, put yourself in different activities, put yourself in a place where you can work on things that will help you in 5-on-5 in a different environment. And I think that's where if the Breeze can consistently tap those buttons, it gets real tricky. And the reason why I brought that up, one is because I think Cam Brink has incredible timing when it comes to like weak side actions or late switches or help in rotating and blocking the ball. I think Kate Martin gets after it, Paige gets after it, although Alyssa Thomas disagreed and decided, hey, you're gonna sit down for a second. But dumb dunk, Nikias.
Yes, she did. She sure did.
What were your thoughts? And what were your thoughts?
One, I was kind of upset because, like, I was trying to fly to Miami. I was trying to figure out, like, the weather situation with where I was. Like, how early do I need to leave? How late do I need to leave? So, like, I was in the air when this happened versus, like, leaving earlier that morning and then being there for that slate, for the Saturday slate of games. So I was like, darn. I wish I would have been in the building when Dom actually got the dunk off. But beyond that, one, obviously great display of athleticism for her. She made it look super easy. Like, she had talked about it, you know, opening week, like, I feel it in my legs. Like, I know I'm going to be able to dunk soon. It's going to be fine. And so it was cool for her to get it. It was very funny that Rekia Jackson is the one that assisted Dom Belonga on this dunk with some of the banter heading into the unrivaled season. Like, hey, she ain't dunking on me. They end up being teammates. So, like, thank goodness on that front. The thing that really got me, Steve, because Dom Belonga, just young and trying to play basketball the right way, Dom just has a lane to the basket that entire possession. And, like, she slows up because she's about to set this drag screen for Rekia Jackson. And I'm just like, dawg, if you don't feel the speed, just go. You do not need to screen right now. Just go. And I'm glad Rekia hit her with the early pass. Like, nah, I don't need a screen, actually. We don't have to run pick and roll right now. Here's the ball. And so for her to have that brief moment, catch it, and then just pretty much dunk on Vert, is where it's just like, oh, well, yeah, we're talking about a totally different level of prospect here in terms of Dom Belonga. So, again, first dunk of the season. It was a fun moment. I did laugh at that, though.
Very good. Can I ask you a fandom question?
Sure.
Because at times it feels like they have another gear that can hit. When you have the versatility they have, Kelsey Plum playing the way that she has, Aaliyah Boston being able to hit you inside and out. But then it feels like the longer we get into the season, teams are like, hey, Kelsey Plum, you're really getting after it and hurting us on this end. Would you like to defend? So I'm interested on your thoughts.
Oh, if I could be respectfully messy / peel back the curtain. So as I was watching that game live, thank goodness, I was obviously excited about it. But watching that game live, the first thing I put in my notes, because naturally this is one of the first things I put up, was like, man, they putting her in action a lot. And I spent pretty much the entire second half trying to figure out how to word a question about KP being put in action with the volume that she was. Because that felt like the most egregious example of mismatch hunting that I have seen in an unrivaled game this season, period. It was over and over and over and over and over. And isn't it pick and roll, let's get a switch, off ball, let's get a switch, quick seal. I'm just like, dog. And so it's just like, I was like, should I just do a general, like, how do you balance mismatch hunting with running the flow of your offense? Do I just keep it that broad? I ultimately just did not ask about it. But I was like, good gracious. I do think teams are probably going to try to do that more often. I don't know if it's going to be to the degree that Rose BC did it. But it's something to keep an eye on, because I think the combination of we can put you in action and force you to guard, plus, we will also do some of the full court pressure thing, depending on who the opponent is, like how we get to the full court pressure stuff, the mist to do it, vinyl to do it. So you have that. And then, as we mentioned a little bit earlier, some teams are just like, actually, what if you just put two on the ball against Kelsey and see what it looks like? The way that she's being treated in the league, she's been very good, of course. And I don't think there's, before anyone tries to clip it, there's nothing malicious or anything like that. But, like, the way she's been treated this season has been one of the more fascinating subplots of the season.
It's because she's good. She's been really, really good. And so, that's what you got to deal with. Let's see. Before I throw the ball to you so we can quickly get out of here, the Lunar Owls, has it been the last hootie hoo for them?
The last hootie hoo. I tell you what, I just want everybody to be healthy. Also, Skylar's starting to look more like herself. Whole lot of drives on some Skylar Diggins this weekend. I would imagine she is going to be in the starting lineup soon. I would love to ask about this week as we're coming up on the Philadelphia games on Friday, so that's going to be fun. But either way, I want to ask about that. But man, it just feels like, and I asked DJ Sackman about this after the game, just like, it feels like they're doing good stuff. It feels like they're doing better stuff on both ends, process-wise. Like, they just cannot put together the full four quarters right now. And he alludes to the same thing post-game. So I'm just kind of waiting on them to get it, because, I mean, Marina in the bucket getting. We've talked about it. Aaliyah Edwards mm-hmm. off the bucket getting. I just really need her to stay healthy. She's taking a lot of bumps this season. Had like a little thumb thing as well. So keep an eye on that. Skylar's starting to look more like herself. You have the shooting, in theory, at least, for Rachel Vanderbilt. Like, there's stuff there. They run good stuff. The season's short, though. They got to stack some wins.
Well, top six get in the playoffs, so they are still knocking on the door, but it's getting interesting because the Hive, while they may not be able to score sometimes, boy, they're going to compete. And the vinyl is vinyl, so it's not easy. But yeah, do you have any final thoughts that you want to share
with the class?
Yeah, last thing I'll say, and then we can get out of here. Going back to the Phantom Rose game, a lot of physicality, which I don't think that's new for Unrivaled overall. But it got to a point in the second half in particular where, like, literally nobody was happy. And, like, every drive, there was something very physical at the point of screens, things like that. There weren't a lot of whistles being blown, and the players were getting very, very, very upset about this. To the point where we had a possession late in that game where there was a drive from Tiffany Hayes. She goes down. She makes the shot. No call. And all you can hear is Natasha Cloud yelling, call the call the foul. Y'all are going to get somebody hurt. I'm just like, well, I don't think that's unfair based on what this game has been. It was just tough. Like, I asked Tiffany Hayes how she was feeling after the game. She's like, oh, I'm fine. Looking up next game. I was like, ah, she is not happy. I am not going to press the issue. It was interesting watching both coaches kind of walk the tightrope talking about the physicality of that game. Because, again, I don't think anybody was pleased by it. And so I am once again keeping an eye on, like, what that part of the program looks like, because they mentioned ahead of the season, like, they do have, like, a system in which to, hey, we don't like how this is being reffed, et cetera, et cetera. Let's talk about this. I got to ask Kate Martin, like, how that process actually works. She gave some cool insight on that, going back to just practice insights and stuff like that. But, yeah, I'm just keeping an eye on how the whistles are being blown in this one, because you don't want anybody to get hurt. You want physicality, you want competitiveness, but you don't want what that game was turning into.
Yeah, time to hold down for the real hoopers and time to resist the urges to not be old. I was born in the late 80s. You play 3-on-3, there's no fouls. I'm not calling my own fouls. My dad told me never call a foul. You play through contact. It's 3-on-3. You hit me if you want. I'm going to still score. That's the whole point. You can foul if you want. If you hack, it's whatever. I'm going to go through you and I'm going to score. Nah. No, we don't need more officiating in 3-on-3. Obviously, I don't want anyone to get hurt. But no, hoop. Speaking of hoop.
Okay.
Speaking of hoop, sign for us to hoop on out of here.
Yeah. Time us to hoop on out. You know what? Thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We're on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel if you haven't already. Get all of our awesome content. You can follow me on socials at TheKaiusNBA. You can follow Steve on socials at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.